Here it comes, the latest people, trends, and news on sustainable living in and around our corner of the country. Down to Earth with Mrs. Green, Spotlight on the Southwest. And now, Mrs. Green.
Welcome, everybody. You are indeed listening to Down to Earth with Mrs. Green, and we're putting a big spotlight on the Southwest tonight. It's going to be a great show. Thanks for joining us. And I just want to mention that the show is made possible through the support of the University of Arizona, which is ranked as one of the top universities in the world as leaders in the science of climate change and climate adaptation. And I invite you to Google that and see what you find, because I did, and the screens light up. And associated research and outreach related to climate change. The University of Arizona has it going on, and it blows me away. I've said this on the show before. I could do a show a day just on things that are going on at the University of Arizona. I am very pleased to have as my guest tonight Jim Beiser. And I said that right, did I not?
Yes, you did.
Okay, it's a tricky spelling. He's a professor at the University of Arizona School of Natural Resources and the Environment and Director of Climate Adaptation and International Development at the University of Arizona's quite prestigious and ever-increasing reputation Institute of the Environment. So welcome. I wanted to give you a very, very special introduction, because I think what you have to share with our audience is of the utmost importance and should be top of mind for every person that's living on the planet today. So I'd like to start off with a quote, if I may. In the myriad of articles I read about you, it says, Jim Beiser's work focuses on climate adaptation, sustainability, and international development. He is leading an effort to establish a network of institutions dedicated to integrating research-based knowledge about climate impacts and options for adaptation into decisions, particularly aimed at sustainable development around the world. And I thought that was a great way to start, because what I really want you to do for the show is share some of the stories you have shared with me, because it's so relatable. How did we start out as a planet in balance? And how did we get to where we are so out of balance in terms of climate change in a really short period of time historically? Mm-hmm. So it's going to be your storytelling that will get people informed and educated about where we are.
Oh, thank you so very much. And it's a real pleasure to be here. I appreciate it very much. The way that I'd like to think about where we are is that it's just been a very, very short time that humans have been on this planet, as we all know. When we think of the millions and hundreds of millions of years and billions of years of our solar system, and it's only been, and this planet has been able to support life because of the very delicate balance in the atmosphere, this thin layer that surrounds our planet, that over the millions of years arrived at this delicate balance of space and chemicals that allowed just the right amount of solar energy to come in, just enough so that as life absorbs the carbon that is necessary for the life, plants and animals, and the rest of the sunlight bounces back out, the radiation bounces back out, and our atmosphere has given us exactly the right balance. And this is very special, because that's been an even a smaller amount of time that we've been able to actually support human life. And so that kind of balance that has been going on for millions and millions of years, only very recently, as you said, has started to go out of balance. And in fact, in some of our lifetimes, what we are doing as we live our lives as humans is actually changing that balance
very quickly. And I think about it a lot, about the, you know, it's not intentional. So the cavemen started burning things, and then we found out about coal, and it would burn slowly, and people weren't measuring what it was doing to that very delicate balance, to that very thin layer that's protecting us. But we've known about it for a while. And then cars came along and nobody said, well, I don't really care about the planet. I want my car. It became a part of the industrialized thrust into the future. So where are we now and how bad is it? Because you're a climate scientist and this isn't about gloom and doom, but it's to know better is to do better. So talk about some of the out of balance places other than burning a big, huge hole that we are doing and what does it look like right today, right now in your world?
Well, one of the things that scientists measure to determine what that balance is measure the carbon in the atmosphere.
Right. And
they're called greenhouse gases because
parts per million.
Yeah, people who know about what a greenhouse looks like, it actually traps more energy than it releases, and so it heats up. And in fact, that's what we are doing. And that's why we call them greenhouse gases, with carbon being the most commonly understood and commonly known and most common of those. And what's happened is that as we've industrialized, and an absolute necessity in industrializing is energy. And our source of energy was, in fact, carbon, which had been trapped over the millions and millions of years as life absorbed it and died and ended up in the earth and got covered up and more. And so that was part of that balance that we talked about, is the planet trapping some of it. What we're doing is now we're releasing it. So it got trapped over millions of years, and we're releasing it in a matter of decades. And so that is what's creating the imbalance. Recently, this count of carbon, it's as measured out of a place in Hawaii.
Which is closed now because there's a government shutdown. So if anything bad's going to happen, don't expect them to tell us. I had to get that in.
Well, yes, and it's still going up even with the government closure. Some things continue to happen.
Some people are watching.
Mother Nature, she will continue to operate. And what happens is that it has gone beyond 400 parts per million. And that is just, that doesn't mean anything in particular other than we notice. And some of us who've been working on this for a long time, been noticing that increase significantly and been watching it and been worried about it.
That's a shocking number. When you know about, you know, Bill McKibben and his work, 350.org. And then the day after that came out, he said, I guess we're going to change it to 400.org. And we were hoping the parts per million would come down.
Indeed.
Maybe I was.
Indeed. And we have been. And so what's happened is, and the reason why this is critically important is we don't actually know. We know a lot about our system, but we don't know what might be some of what we call tipping points, places that actually completely change dramatically. So we don't know what that point is. Is it 450, 451? We just don't know that. And there are parts of our system that have already begun moving in these directions that there really is no turning back. So a big part of our problem is, how do we balance our need for energy and our understanding where we can find cheap energy, and the fact that we're actually changing the chemistry of our atmosphere by going after that cheap energy. So there's an entire side of the problem that is related to what is causing climate to change, and that's a critically important one. And we have some very, very good scientists around the world working on these, including at the University of Arizona and elsewhere in the United States. And we have so leading thinkers in this area, and that is extremely important. Some of us have begun spending our time on something that we perhaps would not have spent our time on some 25 or 30 years ago, but we must now, and that is, okay, we're at 400 parts per million. We actually are starting to feel the effects of that. So we're already starting to feel what
All
over the world, how climate is changing and what those effects are. And then what we're saying to ourselves, okay, even while we try and solve the issue of not putting more carbon up in the atmosphere, we better start preparing for the change that we've already affected. We've already changed the atmospheric chemistry. And we now need to be ready for the changes that we, in fact, are already feeling.
So very clearly, you're the first guest I've had in 6 years that made the differentiation to me of, we talk about climate change and what you are focusing on and other scientists throughout the world is climate adaptation. And I think people need to understand what the difference is. We're not preparing for climate change. We are living.
Yes.
Climate change. So your focus is on adaptation. And you gave an example of bringing it down to the very micro level, a place like Arizona. What that means as the climate changes, we built our economy on tourism, on golf courses, on sunshine, on plants of the desert Southwest, you know, the concept of geotourism. If you're listening to this show and you have a business and you're in business, bring it down to the micro level of what that means and why we need to start adapting quickly.
Precisely. Right. And I'll do that. But I should give you a little bit of backdrop because, again, a way of thinking about it is in this very short period of time when humans have been actually on this planet, it's been even a shorter time, say 10,000 years since the end of the last ice age, that we've begun, and that was with the advent of agriculture, when we figured out how to plant rather than be hunters and gatherers. And we started fine-tuning everything we do, our social and economic systems, to the climate of our place. So let's say here in Arizona or where I'm from in Seattle, if you just think about it, it's fine-tuned to the climate of the place, whether it's what we plant, the food that we grow.
The planting the industry, seasons, everything.
The industries that we have there, even the way we think about ourselves, it has to do with the climate of the place. And what's happened is over those last 10,000 years, we've been gotten very good at fine-tuning so we maximize the value of the climate of our place. So we fine-tuned to the point where we don't have a lot of flexibility, per se, because granted, any kind of climate, even here, we have extremes, we have variability in seasons and years, even in decades that come and go, the wetter and drier periods. And so that fine-tuning means that our systems can handle a certain amount of wetness, a certain amount of dryness, a certain amount of cold, a certain amount of heat, and we build towards that, our built infrastructure included. Well, what's happened now is that as we've changed the climate, we are changing what those extremes look like. So in the Midwest, for example, very recently there was a report of what they considered a 1,000-year flood happening. Well, then they get two of them. So we hear about 100-year floods. Well, what happens when those become commonplace? They're no longer 100-year floods, and the 1,000-year floods become something that happens every few decades. That's what I mean by having our systems tuned to a certain amount of variability, a certain climate. And now that changes.
And megafires, that's another change that's close and near and dear to our heart. That's another impact. When you say, I love that you said, we're changing the climate. It's not a passive thing. It's like we are actively changing the climate.
Not only are we changing the climate, but the way I think about it is, so how do we live in our future climate? Because we will have a climate that is different from this one. That is for certain.
Very quickly.
And how do we live in it? How do we thrive in it? And to your point about very specifics, it really depends on what your industry is. So if you are, let's say, in the hotel industry, and let's say our friends up north, up in Phoenix, from where we are now, they depend heavily on people coming in for the beautiful weather that we have from fall through spring.
Right.
And as climate is changing, things are getting warmer. And as we grow more city, and there's something, a whole different topic called urban heat island, that is we absorb it during the daytime. And what is happening is that our nighttime low temperatures are increasing and have increased about 12 degrees in Phoenix in the last 50 years. So what happens is that people are uncomfortable when that happens. And so perhaps they start arriving later and leaving earlier. That's an impact
major
on our
impact.
Economy.
Major
so if
impact.
I'm a hotel owner, I'm kind of worried about that.
Right. And all of the ancillary things that are out there, the food suppliers and the people that really, it's all part of a massive web of infrastructure.
That's right. That's right. And if I should also, just as a homeowner, be concerned about what is my energy bill going to look like? What is my water bill going to look like when there are stresses that we're not used to having on those
parts of
our system?
What's it going to be like when we really have to pay what it costs to have water?
Well, yeah,
that's another show. Okay.
So if one were to think about climate as being something that we've caused that change by a very necessary, and I keep saying this because it is necessary to have energy. It's just what kind of energy and what is it that we're doing in the long run. that balance and the need to make sure that we're not affecting our future climate, particularly for people my age, for our kids and our grandkids. We're feeling it, but they're really going to feel it.
They're really going to feel it.
And so that I think that whole side of the climate problem is a critically important one, and we need to keep working on it. But back to the part about adapting, that is, you know, how are we going to prepare for the change that is coming, that we're already feeling? And in some cases, we'll be reacting. In some cases, we'll be preparing. And our role as scientists is, can we address the, can we go about creating knowledge through the science in a way that can inform decisions that can help us prepare and help us actually react better? And that, there's a whole field of this science that we refer to as resilience. This is, people are vulnerable to climate change. They're vulnerable to lots of things. In fact, the vulnerability to a changed climate might have something to do with where they are as far as wealth goes, or where they are living, or there are a lot of things other than climate that cause them to be vulnerable, but in comes climate. The resilience thing is, how quickly can we bounce back?
Right.
And so all of that, I'm a strong believer that if we have scientists who are working, dedicating a lot of time and effort and energy on these problems, are thinking through these and testing out methods and approaches to be able to give people who are charged with making decisions on our behalf, these would be industry leaders, political leaders, who planners, who we're relying on, to be able to draw on the knowledge that is being created because of the work that scientists in universities.
So a call to action that some type of synchronized or unified voice, because one of the things that I see sitting here for 6 years is that even the integration, it's the integration of thought. It's one of my favorite things about the Institute of the Environment, because Diana Liverman and Peck, they have a vision for integrating all of these disciplines and having them work together for the environment. I mean, yes, it's a really unique concept. But let me just segue for a second, if it's not too far off point. When you talk about that politically, what do you have to say about our policy on climate action, climate change, any type of climate policy leadership in the political arena in the United States, just in the United States?
Well, if we would have had this show 6 months ago, I would have said the nation has been devoid of any kind of, at least at a national level, on a federal level, of any kind of
real leadership.
Real leadership. But very recently, our president, this past summer, he announced his climate action plan. And while for some of us, we wish that it would have gone further, but But for everyone I know, we're very pleased. This is a first in our professional lives, first in our lifetime, when we've actually seen at the federal level the president come out and say, this is of critical importance and we're doing something about it. And he's called his executive branch agencies to begin coming up with strategies and plans on how they will adapt, both in what they do and their infrastructure to a changing climate. And so I would say that while the federal system has been relatively weak, certainly
late to the party,
actually local governments around our country have actually begun moving. They're essentially saying,
leadership.
We're not going to wait for inside the beltway. We're going to start doing some things. And so the city of New York has, under the leadership of the mayor, has drawn in some of my colleagues up in New York to help advise on how they might prepare for impending climate change impacts in San Francisco and Portland. And so cities, in fact, there's a council of mayors that have come together and come up with their sort of climate statements and action. I work very actively in the higher education sector, under something called the American College and University President's Climate Commitment. Nearly 700 college and university presidents, including University of Arizona and ASU and NAU, have signed their presidents have signed a commitment to reduce the greenhouse gases to zero over a period of time. The same organization that is drawn the higher education to people together around the mitigation side, the reducing of greenhouse gases, is organizing to early next year. We'll come up with a similar initiative, but on the adaptation and preparedness side, on the resilience side, because we as university individuals and scientists and teachers, we need to also play a significant role in that. In fact, the University of Arizona is going to take a leadership role in this effort that is going to involve these 700 plus college and universities around the country. And so this is a sector that has decided they're going to go forward and going to not wait for something to happen in Washington. The cities are doing that, counties around, even the state of California is very active. And as the eighth or ninth largest economy around the world is actually, that's quite significant. So while it can be tiresome and perhaps in some ways depressing.
I think that's really good, fair to say. Some days I said to you off air, I'm like, some days it's downright, wow, we might as well just forget about it, as they say in Jersey, but I'm not going to. No. So, okay, so depressing. You talk about the academia and the leadership in that arena, which is, to me, so rock solid. There mm-hmm. are so many world thinkers that are putting their focus on this and coming up with reasons, scientific information, why it's happening. And then there is some industry leadership. You have some hope for the political leadership. What is it going to take to bring it to the tipping point, or your views on this? It's not fair to ask you to answer the world question about the public's outcry in terms of being part of the shift for the tipping point, because it's the hundreds of millions of people that are going to have to change things in their everyday lives. So what are some of the barriers that you see there, and why aren't people pulling their hair out saying, we've got to stop this, we've got to do this, or I'm going to do this, I'm going to do that, the awareness?
So I think
that's
awareness,
a really long question. Well, but
awareness is a big
awareness,
big, and I think awareness through education, awareness through conversations, awareness through shows like yours, I think those are critically important. When I think about sort of where we are and where we could be, and I give a presentation from time to time in elementary schools, and I've done this for my kids' schools in the past, and when I put up a slide showing an advertisement of Camel cigarettes where in the actual advertisement, a billboard advertisement says 9 out of 10 doctors recommend you smoke Camels. And there's another one that where they're blowing.
Oh my gosh. And
these are real ads from the 1920s, and I show them to the kids, and they don't believe. They think I've photoshopped it. They don't believe that. And when I talk to them about it, and then I think about where we've been and where on the whole issue of tobacco, same sorts of arguments. That are a lot of money is being spent to about those arguments, same sorts of arguments, trying to discredit the science, discredit the knowledge, for frankly business and financial and profit reasons. We're no longer there, and there was an outcry, and you don't smoke.
And things did change.
My kids don't even believe that you used to be able to smoke on an airplane. I can hardly believe it.
I can hardly believe it all either.
And so when we get to the point where enough is known and enough is seen, then I think that we will go over that edge. And by the way, I should say that in some nations, particularly some of the Northern European nations, they're already there.
They are there.
We're not quite there. And I think I was... I'll tell you a little story. When I first got here, I was at the airport, and I was stuck in the line at the ticket counter, and guess who was right in front of me, stuck in the same counter, was Senator John McCain. And so it was just before he had a bill with Joe Lieberman in on climate. And I asked him, so how do you think your bill will do? And he said something to me like, I don't think it will pass. And I said, well, why not? He said, too many special interests in Washington. I said, well, what are we going to do? And he said, well, eventually a bill will pass. And I asked him, well, so why do you say that? He said, because Mother Nature will force us. Well, the question then is, isn't that too late? Of course, his answer was yes. what we will get to the point when we start feeling what we're already beginning to feel, and we start getting Hurricane Katrina's, and we start getting, hearing every day, new record in this, new record rainfall, new record drought, new record heat, new record cold, these extremes, and we're starting to feel them. And we're getting to the point where no one can deny that it's changing. And then they start getting really nervous about it. Unfortunately, by the time we start feeling those changes, we've already changed the atmosphere.
There's a trajectory.
Yes.
And it's a perfect segue to one of the other stories you shared with me, because I believe that one of the ways it's really going to hit us where it hurts is with food scarcity. People call it food security. They call it food insecurity. And New York is a perfect example of what they're doing, because I just spent 10 days back there, and it amazed me what this island is doing for change. I mean, it's apparent everywhere you go. So you shared a story with me. If you hit people where they're eating, you get people's attention. And I knew the story about ocean acidification wiping out entire species of oysters. And I know people that would say, don't take away my oysters. We have the bees at risk. And that would be taking away my almonds if species of bees disappear. I mean, the connection there. So tell the story about ocean acidification, because, again, it's connecting those green dots where, okay, so we have climate change, everything's heating up, including the oceans, and the oysters can't handle it. It's a very personal story of yours. So share.
Well, yes, sure. I'm happy to do that. It as I mentioned, I'm from Washington State, originally going way back. And a friend from college is a major producer in clams and oysters, Taylor Shellfish. He and I were talking one day, and I asked him how things were going. He said, oh, he's having a rough couple of years because he's lost 90% of the larvae of the oysters. What happens is they collect the larvae in containers on land, and then they put them out onto the shells and out into the bay. And I asked him, well, what, did he figure out what that was? And he said, oh, yeah, because the pH level, this would be of the ocean, is actually too low. And for a very short period of the life of this animal, between 1 week and 2 weeks, if it's exposed to a more acidic or a lower pH level, it can't actually survive. And so what happens is that they were able to attribute that to the fact that the ocean's pH is going down. It's a huge, huge place out there, but we're doing enough to the atmosphere. And what happens is that...
delicate balance you talked about that we've had from the beginning of time. And there's another place where it's permeated that delicate balance.
And so what happens, this is his livelihood, and he was very concerned. What happens to the, why is the pH ocean acidification happening is because the ocean absorbs that carbon that is not going back out into the atmosphere that we're burning, and it gets into our atmosphere and it's being absorbed by the ocean. And so the pH goes down, and I asked him, so what has he done? And he went to the University of Washington and Oregon State University, talked to the scientists, and he worked out a near-term solution, which is an adaptation. So here's an example of adaptation.
Right, spot on, climate adaptation.
He's adapting, and what he did was his near-term solution was that the 10% that survived, he was actually able to grow oysters from there that would be a little bit resistant to that pH. And if he could have those survive, then he could have an oyster. Now, you and I don't know what those taste like. I'm assuming that they taste just fine. But the bottom line...
A genetically modified oyster.
The bottom line for him, he was able to adapt. But he really worries that if it gets more acidic, he can't come up. There's got to be a limit to which they cannot adapt. That's the reason why he comes to the scientists. He says what to do. We have a big report coming out in April on the National Climate Assessment that includes some tremendously interesting and innovative ways of addressing exactly these kinds of issues through science.
It'll be great to have you back then to talk about that. Seriously, we can schedule that so that you can have an hour show and hear more. I just got the warning. We have 1 minute, and I never even looked at my notes, because you are indeed not just a great storyteller, but someone that brings such credibility to the telling of your stories, and I appreciate it. So, Jim Beiser from the University of Arizona, you'll be hearing more from Mrs. Green's World about him, and I just want to talk to you about next week. It's another show, Focus on Our Future, insights on climate adaptation about the green homecoming. We're going to have the green cats come on and talk to us from the Institute of the Environment. And again, that was a very tough thing to pull off. It's just not easy to have a green homecoming in terms of producing waste. Jim Beiser from the University of Arizona, thanks for being a part of Mrs. Green's World. Follow me on Facebook and Twitter so you can hear about great shows like this. Make it a great green week, everybody.